Headlines: Iran and Venezuela forging their strategic bonds with a 20-year cooperation deal as President Maduro visits Tehran. The national average price for U.S. gasoline rises above $5 a gallon for the first time ever. West Indian police kill two protesters and arrest more than 130 others during rallies against anti-Islam blasphemous remarks by two ruling party officials. This is news. Thanks for joining us. Iran and Venezuela have pledged to forge closer cooperation on all fronts to further strengthen bilateral relations. To that end, the presidents of the two countries have signed a 20-year cooperation deal. They've also hailed their nation's resistance against foreign pressure.
Venezuela has shown that it has put up exemplary resistance against the enemy's threats, sanctions, and imperialism. The Iranian nation, too, has been under numerous sanctions and threats for more than 40 years now. But the Iranian people have turned these sanctions into an opportunity to further make progress.
We will witness how the new world will take shape and how we will stand up to problems and secure progress. Iranian and Venezuelan youth should know that the future world will enjoy equality and justice, and that we will stand up to imperialism.
President Raisi and his Venezuelan counterpart Maduro said the two countries should work together closely in areas like trade, the economy, agriculture, as well as science and technology. They also hailed the establishment of direct Tehran-Caracas flights as an opportunity to enhance relations and bring the two nations closer together. The Venezuelan president arrived in Tehran on Friday for a two-day official visit. Political analyst Mustafa Hoshesham explains how the close cooperation between Iran and Venezuela is helping them overcome their problems.
Iran rushed to Maduro's help and the Venezuelan people's help. The people were queuing lines, waiting to fill their tanks, car tanks. And Iran sent a dozen tankers, not only taking petrol to Venezuela, but also spare parts for refineries, engineers, technology, and everything, as well as additives and to help the country come back online, bring their refineries back online. And that soothed, actually, the crisis in the country and diffused the U.S. plans for overthrowing the government in there. So the two are also major oil-producing countries and could help each other with, managing the global oil market as we are approaching winter. And then the energy prices are rising because of the Ukraine war, and the U.S. needs much energy imports as well as the Europeans. And they need energy, and the only two countries that might increase supplies in the market and have reserves are Venezuela and Iran. So they could play a major role in coming months with regard to energy market.
Barry Grossman is an international lawyer and political analyst. He says heavy sanctions by the U.S. have failed to make Iran and Venezuela give in.
I cannot think of an example of the U.S. or wider Atlantic world targeting another nation with sanctions that has been even remotely successful in achieving their aims, with the possible exception of apartheid-era South Africa. But even South Africa, it's far from a done deal that the change that unfolded there was due to sanctions. But if we give them that one, that's about the only time sanctions have been effective. In almost every other case, sanctions have either left the target economy stronger or certainly helped produce the resolve amongst the people of that nation to resist with even greater commitment than was the case before the sanctions were imposed. So it's less a question about the efficiency of sanctions, I think, than whether sanctions can ever or have ever achieved what they're meant to achieve. And certainly if the purpose of sanctions is to somehow bring these nations, which the U.S. likes for some reason to consider rogue nations, into line with this international system, which is anything but international, well, then it's a miserable failure.
Soaring inflation in the U.S. pushes fuel prices to record highs. The national average price for gasoline has risen above $5 a gallon for the first time ever. That is an extension of a surge in fuel costs that are a central figure of rising inflation overall. A new report by the U.S. Labor Department says the Consumer Price Index hit a four-decade record in May, surging by 8.6%. President Joe Biden has pulled on numerous levers to try to lower prices ahead of midterm Congress election, but to no avail. Fuel prices continue to surge worldwide due to a combination of rebounding demand in post-pandemic era and sanctions on oil producer Russia over the Ukraine conflict, among other reasons. The former Bolivian President Jeanine Añez has been sentenced to jail for orchestrating a coup that brought her to power during a 2019 political crisis. The court has ruled that 54-year-old Añez will serve 10 years in a women's prison in La Paz. That comes more than a year after she was arrested for an alleged plot to oust her predecessor, Evo Morales. Añez was convicted of making decisions contrary to the Bolivian constitution. She had already announced that she would appeal to international legal bodies if convicted. But Añez still faces a separate pending court case for sedition and other charges. The former army and police heads are also facing a 10-year jail term each. Both are currently on the run. Protests in India take a violent turn. Police have fatally shot two demonstrators during street rallies sparked by blasphemous remarks about the Prophet of Islam by ruling party members. Police in the eastern city of Ranchi say that they were forced to open fire on Muslim protesters to disperse the crowds. Officers also used tear gas and batons on demonstrators. Authorities later cut internet connections and imposed a curfew. Muslim Indians also staged protests in several areas in northern Uttar Pradesh. Police in the northern state say that over 130 protesters were arrested on Saturday. Muslims in India and neighboring countries held sizable rallies on Friday as well. They've been demonstrating since last week when two of Prime Minister Modi's party spokespersons made sacrilegious remarks about the Prophet Muhammad. Indian-controlled Kashmir shuts businesses and shops to denounce blasphemous remarks of two Indian politicians against the Prophet Muhammad. Our correspondent Shana Bhatt reports from Kashmir.
In the Muslim-majority Indian-administered Kashmir, people observed a shutdown to denounce the derogatory remarks by two members of the ruling Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party against Prophet Muhammad. After condemnations by the global Muslim community, the two were suspended. Despite strict security arrangements, people in the summer capital, Srinagar, took to the streets saying they have tolerated everything so far, but nothing against their beloved Prophet.
We demand stringent punishment against these culprits. No religion teaches intolerance. What we see growing attacks on Muslims and their emotions in India now.
These two people have dented the image of Hinduism on the global forum by speaking against the Prophet of Islam. Scores of Muslim countries are today upset about India and its behavior towards minority Muslims. We have tolerated a lot, be it scraping of Article 370 or delimitation, but this time it's about our beloved Prophet. We'll take to the streets without fearing any consequences.
In Srinagar, mobile internet services were suspended as a precautionary measure to avoid the snowballing of protests. Government forces were seen deployed in strength while people closed down businesses, shops and other activities. Last week, BJP suspended its national spokesperson, Nupur Sharma, who made anti-Islam remarks on a TV debate last month. Also, Naveen Kumar Jindal was expelled from the party over his blasphemous tweets about the Prophet Muhammad. The controversial remarks against the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, have sparked global outrage against India. The Muslim community across the world is denouncing the growing anti-Muslim ideology and hate crimes against the minorities in the country. They're accusing BJP of backing anti-Muslim ideology in what they call once a secular India. Shahana Bhatt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Tensions running high between China and the U.S. over Taiwan. Beijing says it will not shy away from entering an all-out war if anyone attempts to split the self-ruled island from mainland China.
Taiwan is a sacred and inalienable part of China's territory. The One China principle is the political foundation of China-U.S. relations. Using Taiwan to contain China is doomed to fail. Minister Wei stressed that if anyone dares to split Taiwan from China, the Chinese military will fight at all costs to resolutely smash any Taiwan secessionist attempt and resolutely safeguard national sovereignty and territorial integrity.
The Chinese official was referring to a Friday meeting between the Chinese defense minister and the Pentagon chief on the sidelines of a security summit in Singapore. Wei Feng told Lloyd Austin that Beijing would smash to smithereens any independence efforts by Taiwan. He also warned about the consequences of Washington's recent move in approving further arms sales to Taipei worth $120 million. He said the move would seriously harm Sino-American relations. The Pentagon chief has accused China of provocative and destabilizing activities near Taiwan. Beijing considers Taiwan as part of its territory and accuses Washington of pushing Taipei to seek independence. Russian and Ukrainian forces are locked in an intense battle in the city of Severodonetsk, one of Ukraine's last holdouts in the eastern Donbas region. Kiev says it remains in control of a chemical plant there, where hundreds of civilians have taken shelter. According to Ukrainian officials, some 800 people are hiding underneath the Azot plant. A pro-Russia representative of the Luhansk region, however, says about 400 Ukrainian troops are holed up there. The official added that those fighters are trying to negotiate their way out of the city, adding that such demands are unacceptable. Elsewhere, Kiev has reported the death of 24 more children in the southeastern city of Mariupol, which was captured by Russia in mid-May. Mariupol's mayor has reported cases of cholera and other infectious diseases there, calling for more humanitarian aid. Meanwhile, Moscow says its air defense forces have shot down three Ukrainian warplanes in southern and northeastern Ukraine. This is while Kiev is asking the West for more advanced weapons. Our correspondent Johnny Miller joined us earlier to fill us in with the latest details on the situation in Ukraine's Donbas region.
Looks like Russian forces are in control of most of the city now. President Zelensky says that this city represents the fight for Donbas. He's exaggerating when he says that there will be other battles before Russia is able to take the whole of Donbas. But Russia, this is an important victory that Russia is securing at the moment. As you rightly say, there is another Azov-style steel plant, if you like, another steel plant in which there are some fighters being hauled up in. There's reports there are some civilians there in which there's negotiations. Now, when in Mariupol, when Ukrainian soldiers stayed inside Azov-style steel plant, it was able to stop the Russian forces from sending troops elsewhere. If you like, holding up the Russian advance, if you will. So it's unclear whether maybe that's what Ukraine is trying to do again, hold up the Russian advance by keeping soldiers in a steelworks in the city of Severodonetsk. It was an interesting piece by the Guardian newspaper today, quite a staggering piece, actually. It said that between 600 and 1,000 Ukrainian soldiers were being killed or wounded every day, which, if that is true, it's a staggering number. Works out about 20,000 a month. Obviously, these figures would be unsustainable for Ukraine. The article goes on to say that Ukraine is running out of ammunition. Many Ukrainians have admitted that they're running out of ammunition. So the article was saying very much this could be a turning point.
Iranians are celebrating the birthday anniversary of Imam Reza, the 8th Shia Imam and the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. Thousands of Muslims thronged the holy shrine of Imam Reza in Iran's northeastern city of Mashhad to mark the occasion. Yusuf Jalali reports.
This is the spiritual capital of Iran. The holy shrine of Imam Reza in Mashhad has attracted thousands of pilgrims to celebrate the birthday of the 8th Imam of Shia Islam. Imam Reza was born on the 11th of the lunar month of Dhul-Qa'dah in 766 AD in the Saudi city of Medina. He is one of the descendants of Prophet Muhammad. Every year, millions of Shia Muslims visit his magnificently decorated shrine to pay homage to him.
I am so happy to take part in the birthday anniversary of Imam Reza. He was a man of wisdom whose views on life continue to inspire us Muslims.
We came here with our family to celebrate this auspicious occasion. When we attend Imam Reza's shrine, it gives us serenity and peace, as Imam Reza was a man of God.
12 Shia believe in 12 Imams or religious leaders, all of whom share the same bloodline that goes back to the Prophet of Islam, Muhammad. Muslims believe without the Imams, Islam, as introduced by the Prophet, could have gone astray.
Imam Reza, as with every other imam, was the guardian of Islam. He protected our religion from being distorted by the corrupt rulers who ruled under the banner of Islam, but acted against the teaching of our prophet.
Imam Ali is our first imam, and Imam Mahdi is the last one who is believed to be the savior of the world. We are all waiting for his arrival.
Imam Reza holds a special position among Iranians since he spent his last years in Iran. According to historical accounts, the imam was invited by Abbasid Caliph Ma'mun from Medina to Mashhad to hold the position of crown prince of the Islamic territory. During his tenure, Imam Reza exposed the corruption entrenched in the Abbasid dynasty, and that led to his tragic fate when Ma'mun forced him to drink poisoned grapes.
Shia Muslims regard Imam Reza as a bless, a bountiful source of spirituality that never ceases to pacify the pilgrims of his shrine. And this, they say, is the secret to the unwavering love Shia Muslims still have for their eighth imam, centuries after his time. Yusuf Jalali from the shrine of Imam Reza in Mashhad.
And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. In the United States, Rudy Giuliani has been hit with ethics charges over baseless claims he made about the 2020 presidential election being stolen while serving as an attorney for former President Donald Trump. The charges come a day after a primetime hearing by the House panel investigating the Capitol attack. The article you're about to hear has been written by staff at the Reuters news agency. The piece is titled, Rudy Giuliani Charged with Ethical Misconduct Over Trump's Big Lie. In the United States, Rudy Giuliani has been hit with ethics charges over baseless claims he made about the 2020 presidential election being stolen while serving as an attorney for former President Donald Trump. The charges were filed on Friday, 10th of June, by the District of Columbia office that polices attorneys for ethical misconduct. The Washington, D.C. Office of Disciplinary Counsel alleges that Rudy Giuliani, who is a member of the D.C. Bar, made baseless claims in federal court filings about the results of the 2020 presidential election in Pennsylvania. The charges were filed with the District of Columbia Court of Appeals Board on professional responsibility. A lawyer for Rudy Giuliani did not have an immediate comment. The charges come a day after the U.S. House Select Committee investigating the January 6th Capitol attack had its first primetime hearing, in which it outlined evidence that Donald Trump and his allies sought to overturn the 2020 election and incite throngs of Trump supporters to block Congress from certifying Joe Biden's victory. Giuliani, a former U.S. attorney in Manhattan and a former mayor of New York City, has been among Donald Trump's most fervent supporters and repeatedly claimed without evidence that the election had been stolen. The complaint says Rudy Giuliani sought an emergency order to prohibit the certification of the presidential election, an order to invalidate ballots cast by certain voters in seven counties, and other orders that would have permitted the state's assembly to choose its electors and declare Trump the winner in Pennsylvania. The charges say his conduct violated two professional conduct rules in Pennsylvania that bar attorneys from bringing frivolous proceedings without a basis in law or fact and prohibit conduct that is prejudicial to the administration of justice. These charges against Rudy Giuliani can lead to the suspension of a license to practice law or disbarment. The charges mark the second time that a bar office has taken action against Rudy Giuliani. His New York law license was suspended in June of 2021 after a state appeals court found that Giuliani made demonstrably false and misleading statements that widespread voter fraud undermined the election. Apart from having two of his law licenses suspended, Giuliani's reputation has been stained by his dealings with Ukraine, and he is being investigated by Manhattan federal prosecutors over those business ties with Ukraine. He began representing Donald Trump, a fellow Republican and New Yorker, in April of 2018, in connection with then special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation that documented Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election. Rudy Giuliani has not been charged with criminal wrongdoing. His lawyer has said the federal investigation is politically motivated. Meanwhile, Thursday's opening session of primetime televised hearings into storming of Capitol Hill on 6th of January 2021 was both revealing and disturbing. The revelations of what exactly took place when a violent mob broke into the halls of U.S. Congress seeking to overturn a Democratic election by preventing the formal certification of Joe Biden's victory are a valuable and shocking addition to the historical record. The House of Representatives Committee that has been investigating the attempted insurrection for the past year, gathering in excess of 140,000 documents and speaking to more than 1,000 witnesses, discovered that Donald Trump's response on learning that the rioters were chanting "Hang Mike Pence," his vice president was to say that his vice president deserved it. Previously unseen video footage and fresh testimony buried the suggestion made by one Republican congressman that the behavior of the insurrectionists on 6th of January 2021 was like a normal tourist visit, or that it was, as Fox News' most watched host, Tucker Carlson, was still insisting on Thursday, no more than a forgettable minor outbreak of violence. Instead, one police officer, Caroline Edwards, who suffered a traumatic brain injury as the Capitol was breached on 6th of January 2021, described being stampeded, knocked unconscious, pepper sprayed and tear gassed by the rioters. There was so much blood on the floor, she slipped over. It was carnage, she said. It was chaos.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
A former head of Israeli regime's Mossad spy agency was deported from the Democratic Republic of Congo in 2019 after it emerged that he was involved in a plot to overthrow the country's president. During his visit to the DRC, the top Mossad spy was accompanied by Israeli oligarch Dan Gertler, who is involved in looting Congo's mineral resources, such as cobalt, while indigenous people are languishing in poverty. A Congolese professor elaborates here on how plundering by capitalists such as Gertler has destroyed the country. Hello and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. This week, we are focusing on Israeli regime's destabilization activities in Africa. The Tel Aviv regime dispatched its top spy to the Democratic Republic of Congo to plan a coup against a democratically elected government. So why is the Tel Aviv regime meddling in the DRC? This is one of the questions our expert will be answering. The second part of our program will be on some of the challenges Africa faces in improving energy access as it seeks to industrialize. So stay with us as our experts give us their incisive analysis.
Mossad meddling in the DRC. The former chief of Israel's Mossad spy agency, Yossi Cohen, was humiliated after he was deported from the Democratic Republic in 2019. According to media reports, his ejection from Kinshasa came after the country's president obtained classified reports that the Mossad chief was planning a coup against him. The expose on the Israeli regime's plot to overthrow DRC's government comes when the regime has been lobbying to be an observer member of the African Union.
Leading Pan-Africanist Pierre Lumumba in voicing his opposition to the Israeli regime's observer status at the AU said the Tel Aviv regime might be pursuing hidden objectives in its attempt to infiltrate Africa.
I find no merit in Israel enjoying observer status at the African Union. And thirdly, I am puzzled why that is important at all. I do not see any value at all that is added by Israel enjoying observer status at the AU, unless there are certain subterranean political interests which are at play in this particular matter.
Well, for more on the Israeli regime's meddling in the Democratic Republic of Congo, we have contacted Kambale Musavuli, a human rights activist and an analyst at the Center for Research on the Congo. Thanks a lot, sir, for joining us today.
Thank you.
Now, can you give us a brief account on what led to the humiliating expulsion of the Mossad spy agency chief in the Democratic Republic of Congo?
We know that Congo, the Congolese president, became very close to Israel. I believe that he felt that by becoming close to Israel, that would give him some cover to rule the Congo and control the country. But it was a surprise to him that while he was close to Israel, there was something else happening. The first visit is unclear of when it took place. The second visit, we know, took place on October 9th of 2019, right when the president of the Congo was traveling to the eastern part of the country. And it's very important to look at that context. The head of Mossad came into the DRC when the president of the Congo was traveling to the east, and at the same time, the same day he was traveling to the east, one of the planes with Congolese soldiers and some of his vehicles, bulletproof vehicles and so on, got into an accident, right? There was a plane crash of the presidential convoy. So that raised a lot of suspicion about why the Mossad head was in DRC unannounced twice already, without the country knowing why he was coming there.
During his visit to Kinshasa, the Mossad chief was in the company of Gertler, one of former President Joseph Kabila's closest business cronies. This corrupt Zionist wheeler dealer is said to have bribed Congolese authorities to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars in exchange for mining rights in the DRC. Gertler recently signed a deal with the current government in Kinshasa that would allow the DRC to recover looted mining and oil assets of Gertler's company Ventura, worth more than $2 billion. That's a colossal amount of money looted from a country with some of the poorest people on earth. Is Mossad involved in the looting of DRC's wealth?
The New York Times had an expose that explained who Dirk Gertler was. Cohen traveling to DRC with Dan Gertler may be a shock to people. But we in the DRC, especially at the Center for Research of the Congo, we have studied for quite some time Dan Gertler's dealing in the DRC. We're not that surprised. He's a very powerful businessman in the DRC. He's made billions of dollars on shady deals in the DRC. And in the New York Times expose that I'm referencing, it was clearly stated that he is an intelligence asset for Mossad and serves for U.S. national interests in Central Africa.
The Israeli regime has close ties with the former and current DRC president, and this has raised questions on what Cohen was really pursuing in Kinshasa. Now, is it possible that different Israeli regime factions are competing for the control of the DRC, especially since the current president, Felix Tshisekedi, who was reportedly almost deposed by Mossad, also enjoys close ties with the Israeli regime?
The engagement of Felix to Israel has been to continue the policies of his predecessors, of using Israel as the space or the country for access for intelligence tools. Some of the Israeli companies have been engaged in the Congo. NSO, that pretty much manufactured or created the Pegasus virus. Now, NSO is still operating in DRC. There is no indication that they have stopped under the Tshisekedi regime. We know there are other Israeli interests there. But the most important under the Felix regime, the most important engagement is that under his regime and under his the Congo being the chairman of the African Union, the DRC played a central role with the chairperson of the AU Commission to recognize Israel as a member state of the African Union. So that's why Israel needed the DRC.
The Israeli regime had close military links with the apartheid regime in South Africa and Rwanda during the 1994 genocide. The regime has also been selling weapons, fueling civil wars in several African countries. Now, the Israeli regime is literally plundering the resources of the Democratic Republic of Congo, widely considered to be the richest country in the world in terms of natural resources. Considering the foregoing, can we say that the African Union should categorically reject the Israeli regime's attempt to become an observer member?
I mean, the decision for Israel to become an observatory member of the African Union did not come from the African people. Now, African people have always been on the side of the Palestinian people. The African Union has put a statement denouncing the apartheid that the Palestinian people live in, that's imposed on them by Israel. So we, the African people, are very clear about what the Palestinian people are living. What took place was an undemocratic process of electing or pretty much imposing on the African people the status of Israel within the African Union.
It is quite interesting that the Israeli regime sought to oust DRC's president and at the same time used him in its attempt to gain observer status at the African Union. Now, very briefly as we wind up, should this be a warning bell to African leaders that they cannot trust the Tel Aviv regime?
Those leaders on the African continent who are supporting Israel, behind their backs, Israel is plotting a coup in the case of the Congo. While the Congolese president is supporting Israel, the head of intelligence of Israel, Cohen, allegedly was plotting a coup in DRC. That's a signal for those leaders who are supporting Israel that they may even turn against you. So they should be on the side of the African people, of supporting the people of Palestine, demanding that the Palestinians can return on their land, control their own affairs, and live peacefully and freely in their land like any human being should live.
Well, we'd like to thank Mr. Kambale Musavoli of the Center for Research on the Congo for his incisive analysis. Now we now take a short break, and when we come back, we shall be talking about the status of the access to electricity in Africa. Stay with us.
Lighting up Africa.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Electricity access is one of the biggest developmental challenges facing many African countries. Millions of people across the continent live in complete darkness, unable to access electricity for basic household use such as lighting, charging phones, and laptops.
In their recent book titled The Challenge of Energy Access in Africa, authors Manfred Hafner, Simone Talia Pietra, and Lucia de Strasser identified four major problems militating against energy access on the continent. Decades of neglect in building up countrywide infrastructure, a lack of international investment, poor regulatory frameworks, and difficulties surrounding bankability of power projects.
According to the Africa Development Bank, over 640 million Africans have no access to energy, corresponding to an electricity access rate for African countries at just over 40%, the lowest in the world. Now, the president of the Africa Development Bank Group, Akinwumi Adesina, says lack of electricity is killing industries in Nigeria, Africa's largest economy.
You see, ladies and gentlemen, a lack of electricity is killing Nigerian industries. Something Chief Odutola was concerned about way back in 1971. According to the Manufacturers Association of Nigeria, industry spent $93.1 billion, and billion naira, I must say, on alternative energy in 2018. That is 47 years after Chief Odutola. Today, no business can survive in Nigeria without generators. Consequently, the abnormal has become normal.
Well, for more on the state of electricity supply in Africa, we contacted Lawrence Freeman, a political economic analyst for Africa. Thanks a lot, sir, for joining us today.
Okay.
Now, why is access to electricity the biggest development challenge facing many African countries, yet the continent is home to vast energy resources?
The problem is that the African nations have never been able to build up the infrastructure, of which energy is the most important feature, for their economies. Don't forget, since the emergence of the African nations in the 1960s, there has been, from the West, a refusal to help these nations actually develop by making investments in infrastructure, by making investments in energy. All kinds of aid has been delivered, and all kinds of speeches have been made. And the lack of energy in Africa is literally killing Africa, not figuratively, but literally, because you can't have an industrialized economy without energy. And if you don't have an industrialized economy, people live in poverty and die.
South Africa, Africa's second largest economy, has the highest energy consumption on the continent. Yet unscheduled power outages are on the increase. The country's president, Cyril Ramaphosa, last year announced another project to deal with the country's energy crisis.
Through this Hydrogen South Africa strategy, government and its partners have successfully deployed hydrogen fuel cells to provide electricity in some of our schools, and to build hospitals established as part of the country's COVID-19 response.
North Africa seems to be relatively well off compared to sub-Saharan Africa in terms of access to electricity. What is the situation in African countries such as Nigeria and South Africa?
Across sub-Saharan Africa, not counting the Maghreb, in sub-Saharan Africa, the lack of energy is pervasive and deadly. And there's no country. Look, there's only 100 to 110,000 megawatts of power capacity for over a billion people in sub-Saharan Africa. 40,000 is produced in South Africa, but South Africa doesn't have enough energy. And you have other countries like Nigeria, which are living on less than 100 watts of electricity per capita. So there is no good news story. There is no one, there's no country who's delivering energy, and not even close to the energy that's needed. My estimates are we need 1,000 gigawatts of electricity, and all we have is 100,000 megawatts. So the deficit is striking.
Ethiopia's Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam is said to be the largest hydroelectric scheme in Africa, but has been at the center of regional dispute. Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed officially inaugurated electricity production from the country's mega dam on the Blue Nile in February.
Now, Mr. Freeman, what impact will the Ethiopia dam have on efforts to ensure greater access to electricity in African countries?
The most significant development is Ethiopia has a Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, GERD. And they embarked on this about 10 years ago. And within the next month or two, they will be involved in the third filling of this dam. This will be the largest dam on the continent of Africa. It will have a reservoir of about 74 billion cubic meters, estimated to generate over 6,000 megawatts. Now, this will be a significant increase for Ethiopia, and they will also export energy to the region, Kenya, South Sudan, maybe Tanzania. But it's still not enough, but it's a big development.
Now, although many in other continents are moving towards nuclear energy, South Africa remains the only African country that generates nuclear energy. Other countries such as Nigeria, Egypt, and Kenya have plans to set up nuclear power plants. Now, do you think nuclear energy can be an option for Africa?
You have about 16 or 17 African countries in various phases of acquiring nuclear energy, which would be the best for Africa, and it's the best form of energy. Egypt, I think, is working with Russia to build several nuclear energy plants. South Africa is embarking on a plan to build possibly four nuclear power plants, and many other countries, Ghana, Nigeria, and others, are in the process of acquiring permits and feasibility studies. This would be a huge increase for Africa to start deploying nuclear energy.
A recent report by Wood Mackenzie Limited says sub-Saharan African countries will need to invest as much as $350 billion between now and 2030 to be able to considerably improve electricity and generation distribution. Now, is this objective achievable in your opinion?
What I've been working on with my African friends is to establish an Africa Infrastructure Development Bank, which would be a bank that would lend out money, credit, for infrastructure, of which energy would be the primary, along with high-speed railroads, would be the most important investments for this infrastructure bank. And the West just turns away, a blind eye, to the actual needs of Africa and energy. And without energy, you won't solve the food crisis. Without energy, you won't end hunger. Without energy, you won't end poverty, and yet the Western institutions do nothing but complain and feel bad, but they won't make the investment necessary. Russia and China and India will probably do more in providing nuclear energy for Africa than the West.
According to some reports, over 30% of electricity in France generated by uranium for Niger, yet only 1 in 7 Nigerians have access to modern electricity services. Can we say that the exploitation by former colonial powers such as France is a major factor in lack of electricity in Africa?
And it's true, the French, never developed their 14 countries that are part of Francophone arrangements. And they basically are carrying out the colonial policy of taking the resource of uranium to develop their own energy base, nuclear base, and doing nothing to help Niger.
Renewable energy's potential across the African continent remains largely untapped. Now, the president of the Africa Development Bank says the bank is funding renewable energy projects in the continent. Let's take a listen.
Africa has abundant energy resources, including solar, hydro, geothermal, and also wind. The African Development Bank is spearheading investments in renewable energy. And guess what? 85% of all the African Development Bank's investment in energy is in renewable energy.
Now, my last question to Mr. Freeman, what is preventing the wider use of renewable energy sources such as solar, which is readily available across Africa?
Well, it is, and the problem you have is you have a whole colonial mindset which dominates the West. There's a totally different thinking coming from China in particular. The West, in their colonial mindset, have never intended to develop Africa. We have an anti-development mindset, which corresponds in some ways to a colonial mindset. And this continent with all these resources has never been developed, and that's by intention. And that is very sad, and that's what I'm trying to change with my work and my website and my writings and my lectures.
Well, there you have it. Western neocolonial powers led by the United States prefer an underdeveloped Africa so that they can continue looting the continent's resources. That's the opinion of Lawrence Freeman, an expert on African affairs. We'd like to thank him for his insight on the subject. Well, and that wraps it up for this week's edition of Africa Today. Send us your comments through our social media handle. Take care and goodbye for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.